The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Our guest today is Dr. Valter Longo, a biochemist and one of the world's leading researchers into aging. Professor Longo has done decades of research in genetics, nutrition, stem cells, and cellular regeneration to create a dietary approach that mimics the effectiveness of fasting, but without the hunger. His fasting mimicking diet, or FMD, is described in his new best-selling book, The Longevity Diet. Through his research, he reveals how adhering to this diet triggers cellular regeneration and rejuvenation and reduces the risk of cardiovascular, neurodegenerative, and autoimmune diseases, diabetes, cancer, and dementia. Dr. Longo is professor of gerontology and biological sciences and director of the Longevity Institute at the School of Gerontology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He's also director of the Laboratory of Oncology and Longevity at the Institute of Molecular Oncology in Milan. Professor Longo received the Nathan Schock Lecture Award from the National Institute on Aging in 2010 and the 2013 Vincent Cristofalo Rising Star Award for Research on Aging and the 2016 Glenn Medical Foundation Award for Research in the Molecular Mechanisms of Aging. Time magazine has called him a, quote, guru of longevity, end quote. Dr. Longo was born and raised in Genoa, Italy, and received his undergraduate degree from the University of North Texas, where he majored in biochemistry with a minor in jazz performance. He received his PhD in biochemistry from the University of California, Los Angeles in 1997 and his postdoctoral training in the neurobiology of aging and Alzheimer's disease at USC. He has been at the University of Southern California School of Gerontology since 2000, which is one of the leading programs for aging research. Today, we'll discuss the fascinating research behind his fasting-mimicking diet. I would also like to mention that all of the proceeds from his book, The Longevity Diet, are donated to charities as well as to his ongoing research. Dr. Longo, thank you so much for joining us from Italy today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, we're so honored.
It was a long introduction there.
Well, there was a lot to say. And I think the only thing we shared in common is I have a background in biochemistry.
good try.
That's fascinating. One of the things I appreciate the most about the longevity diet is, you know, it's so evidence-based. And as someone who is involved in research as well as in clinical medicine, you know, there's so many diets out there. But the merit really, as you point out, is that there's convergence of science on some of the diets, meaning that whether you look at the diet from a basic science approach through epidemiology, centenarian studies, control trials, all the different methods, there's a convergence as the diet that can stand out as one that truly is best for our health and longevity. And that's precisely what you've done. Can you kind of talk a little bit about your work that's led to this? Because decades of research have gone into what you've kind of collated into a book.
Yeah, so essentially, I started with mice and humans in the Walford Laboratory back in 1992 at UCLA. But then I realized that really provided one pillar, what I call one pillar, which is clinical studies, and maybe one and a half pillars, and maybe some basic research. And I thought, well, it's important to go back to the basics and find out what the genetics of aging are. And so I spent, you know, the next 10 years or so in other laboratories looking at the genes that control aging. And to then, once I felt that there was a genetic foundation and also this historical foundation of the work on calorie restriction in humans and mice, then I moved back to mice and then eventually to clinical trials and to epidemiological studies. And so, you know, that sort of really represented 25 years of work. And after 25 years of work, I felt you could always wait forever, but I felt that it was enough and it was so solid that I could write something that could help lots of people, like I help myself. I mean, I always started with myself, and I used to have high blood pressure and high cholesterol. And so did, I forget Walford, but I remember, I have this vague memory that he also used it on himself for that purpose. So yeah, so these interventions work very well, and they can keep people healthy for a long time. The trick was, how do you get all the benefits without any side effects? And that's what we really worked on for so long. And I think now we've succeeded in at least identifying the first set of recommendation to get somebody to very old ages as healthy as possible.
That's perfect. And there are really two dietary patterns you've combined in this book. One is the longevity diet overall that one should follow on a regular basis, and then the fasting mimicking diet that people should do intermittently. And I want to talk about elements of both. You know, in some ways, the longevity diet overlaps with some of the very well-established research that you've cited. And then there are ways where it slightly deviates, but in very subtle ways. And I wanted to go through that because, again, there's so much confusion around some of the recommended diets that it's helpful to find the overlap and synergy and the methodology and the reasoning behind some of the variations. So the longevity diet, as a lot of epidemiologic and randomized control trials suggest, is largely plant-based with some fish. And just like a lot of the large epidemiologic studies, like the health professional studies and the nurses health study, as well as the controlled trials like PREDIMED, you minimize saturated fats and sugar and maximize good fats and complex carbs. The protein part is the part that I found the most interesting. You know, you recommend keeping the protein level, you know, you recommend low, which is at 0.31 to 0.36 grams per pound, which really works out to the recommended 0.8 grams per kilogram. And it's interesting that you reference
the minimum recommended.
Yes, the minimum recommended, exactly. And I found it interesting that the minimum recommended is what you considered low, which almost implies that most people have a high protein diet in excess of what's needed.
Hence, most people do, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Some people are malnourished, right? So this is the interesting part, right? So most people eat too much proteins and too much animal food, and a percentage of people eat too little. So lots of people, for example, they go to a vegan diet. Mm-hmm. And most of the vegans I talk to, they may be protein deficient. So that's interesting too, right? So that you mentioned similarities, but I will argue the devil is in the detail. And when we looked at people that had high protein and low protein diet, there was no difference unless you split them by age groups, right? And then, and this is what we suspected based on biochemistry data, which is that you wanna keep low protein but sufficient up to age 65, 70, and then switch to a higher, gradually a higher protein, but also a more variety, a more variable diet, right? It seems like little differences, but the epidemiological data would suggest they're huge. They can make a difference whether all that effort has any effect on mortality or not, right? So, yeah, this is why the science is so important, because lots of the times I hear the journalists arguing, oh, you know, some of these things we've known forever. And that's not true. You know, we have ideas, you know, very general ideas, but these general ideas, if they're not put together in a correct way, they can do as much good as they do bad. Calorie restriction, again, being an example of it. But most of the diets, you know, most of the diets, for example, the very few people know the Italians, some of the Italian population, they live very long, but they're very frail. They're twice as frail as Northern Europeans, right? So, you know, again, the devil is in detail. You don't want to make it to 100 years of age and be frail for 30 years. You want to make it to 100 years of age and be fairly strong and all the way to maybe a few years before before you die.
Right. And you're absolutely right about the devil being in the detail, because, you know, a lot of people quote the China study, which recommends the lower protein even after age 65. And as you point out,
first of all, recommends a vegan diet, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a mistake for most people, because most people that switch to a vegan diet are going to be malnourished. And, you know, not because the vegan diet is malnourished by itself, but that's just the reality. This is why it's so important, like we do, to run epidemiological and clinical studies, because then you see these things, right? You see that, yes, I can tell somebody to be on a vegan diet, but what do they really do with that, right? Are they going to listen to all the explanation, or are they just going to eat 10 grams of protein per day? Lots of them will eat 10 grams of protein per day.
Right, right. So with really any diet, the labels don't help, because you can have a healthy vegan diet and then a not healthy vegan diet. It's, as you say, what's in that diet that ultimately matters. And the protein issue, in terms of the source and the age, you know, the underlying benefit of maybe introducing more protein and possibly some animal sources after 65 is really in the effect on the insulin growth factor. Are there other factors that you think make that a distinct difference that we should follow?
Yes, I think that, for example, if you take mice and they're young and you give them a 4% protein diet, they're fine, right? It's very, very low protein. They're fine. If you take old mice and you give them the same low protein diet, they start losing weight very rapidly. So probably as people get older, the redundancy is reduced. In addition to IGF-1 levels, the redundancy goes way down, meaning that they really depend on a few systems to do things, to get things accomplished. And so that narrow type of diet might not be sufficient to feed systems that are progressively more dysfunctional. So for example, normally you might need so many grams of leucine to drive muscle synthesis through the TOR pathway. Well, when you get older, those grams might go up by 20, 30, 40%, right? So now if you have already a low protein diet to begin with, and you continue that, this could be okay until you're 60 years old, but then eventually it'll cause problems, for example, in frailty and cachexia, or certainly muscle weakness.
And is that driven by the effect of insulin, like growth factor, being stimulated by protein intake and needing more as you're older, because you ideally want a lower level, less than 65, but as you get older, want a slightly higher level for muscle synthesis?
It's possible that it's partially helping the IGF-1 go back to a more youthful level. You know, as you know, IGF-1 declines with aging in most organisms, and including humans. And it is possible that by increasing, and we also know that people that have very low IGF-1, they tend to do poorly. Now, you know, it may be a consequence of problems and not the cause of problems. But certainly, if you have an IGF-1 of 40, usually they don't do very well. And so as you get older, the IGF-1 goes progressively lower. And it is possible by having a higher protein diet that helps. But I think it's also not just the IGF-1 and not just the proteins, but also some of the more nutrient-rich food, let's say eggs, milk, yogurt. I think that these high nourishment foods may provide a benefit for systems that are becoming progressively less able to utilize well whatever low levels of ingredients you might have. So let's say you're B12, you have low B12, and you have low vitamin D, and you have low folic acid. As long as the system is fairly young, it can deal with it. once a system gets in the 70s and 80s, it can no longer work well under those limited conditions.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, another thing that I thought was really interesting that you point out is that, you know, conventional wisdom is three meals a day. And you also, you know, bring up the point that for some people, maybe two meals a day may be more appropriate. And there's a lot of really evolutionary history behind this of us, you know, throughout various time periods, not reliably getting three meals a day. Can you talk more about the benefits of not always having three meals a day?
Yeah, so the concern is double. One, as lots of experts, let's say, started saying eat five or six times a day, people started doing that because it was the general recommendation to lots of people, still is. And then they started increasing the number of hours of food consumption. And now it's about 15 hours a day. So 15 and a half. So now, dual problem. You eat too many meals, you eat for too long. So now the ideal seems to be 12 hours. And I think also one of the easiest way to regulate whether somebody overeats or not is to just say, you can only have, let's say, two meals plus a snack. That's it. Very simple. You can not follow it, but if you do follow it, for most people, it will take care of the problem. And I always say, when I follow lots of people doing these diets, and I would say the hard part is the first month or so or two. Once you get used to the new this new pattern, then it's no problem at all. I mean, I've been using it myself for many years. Whenever I tend to gain weight, sometimes when I come to Italy or maybe when I come back to the United States, either way, it can get me that stage. Then I usually don't like to do or recommend that people remove completely the meal because, again, I don't want to introduce these long fasting periods, which we can talk about, but they seem to be negative. Try to keep it 12 hours, and in that have two major meals plus a snack. And usually I do that for lunch. So my lunch becomes, let's say, a salad or some nuts or, you know, something fairly small, a couple hundred calories that it's really very low in calories. Yeah. Very low in calories and very low also in carbs, yeah.
Yeah, and talking about the different methods of fasting, it's probably become kind of a pet peeve of yours that so many regimens have been kind of put under this big category of intermittent fasting, whereas, you know, what you're proposing is so different and so science-based compared to a lot of the alternate methods that are all kind of now lumped together into this category of intermittent fasting. The fasting mimicking diet has some very unique parts to it. Can you talk more about the science and kind of, I guess, the right way to do fasting if you're going to fast?
Yeah. So I, being a student of Roy Walford, and I've seen really what's been 100 years of research on calorie restriction, I learned the hard way, if you will, that if you don't have a much more sophisticated and tested system, it will do as much good as it will do bad. And so calorie restriction is a good example of that. If you take somebody and you always restrict them in calories, you're going to see lots of benefits. But then you're going to start seeing lots of problems, right? They're going to become anorexic and they're going to become weak, and et cetera, et cetera. So the fasting mimicking diet was really 25 years of response to that. Right? So when I took over, let's say, from Walford, we knew that there were extraordinary effects of calorie restriction, which Walford already knew that at UCLA, but then it was Weindruck and others that confirmed that with monkeys at the University of Wisconsin. And so, for example, diabetes in the monkeys that were calorie restricted went from 60% to zero, or insulin resistance. Cardiovascular disease cut by 50%. Cancer cut by 50%. And so, but then the monkeys didn't really live longer, or just lived a little bit longer. Right? So obviously there's so many problems that are able to counterbalance all these incredible effects. And so the fasting mimicking diet is really 25 years of research devoted to how do I get these benefits, if not even better than calorie restriction? How do I remove the burden of having to be pushed to the limit every day? And how do I remove the side effects, which are obviously wiping out the positive effects, maybe by introducing more infectious diseases, more problems with wound healing, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, so that's the fasting mimicking diet. And the fasting mimicking diet is really about, it's not intermittent fasting, although people always put it in the intermittent fasting group, but it's really, the ambition is to be next to the medicine, next to the drugs in the doctor's office, as a way to address the problem from the foundation. So if somebody shows up with insulin resistance, yeah, you can load them up with metformin, et cetera, et cetera. Somebody shows up with high cholesterol, yes, you can load them up with statins, but you're not going to solve the problem. In fact, you're going to create a problem that's going to get progressively worse. And then you go from one drug to two, to three, to four. And we all know how many drugs the typical American 65-year-old takes now. So that's not the way. And so the fasting mimicking diet has the ambition to say, I think we can do better. And I think we can do better much cheaper and fix the problem from its foundation by taking an insulin-resistant muscle cell and making it insulin-sensitive. Taking a liver that is making C-reactive protein and removing the inflammation, removing the problem, and starting from zero, lowering the fat in the liver, lowering the fat in the visceral area in the abdomen without decreasing lean body mass, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all those are not ideas. We have actually published this in clinical trials and we're going to do more and more of these clinical trials. And so, this is now a reality. And understanding that we need to do more, maybe in the sense of bigger numbers. But we already know that for lots of these things, it will work very well.
Yeah. And when people do the 5-day fasting mimicking diet, a lot of physiologic changes start to happen, as you're referring to, in terms of regeneration and rejuvenation, activation of stem cells. Can you talk through the science of what's happening when people do the 5-day intermittent, or not intermittent, but the fasting mimicking diet?
Yeah, so most of the mechanisms, I mean, we have the human trials and they work very well, but the mechanisms, of course, we're limited to the mice. We know that things change in people, let's say IGF-1, IGF-PP1, ketone bodies, glucose, etc. So we know the changes occur similarly to the mice, but we cannot say, stem cells are causing this effect. But in mice, it's very clear the stem cells and the regeneration is causing lots of effects. So we can damage, for example, the pancreas and they damage the insulin-producing beta cells. And then we start the FMD, and we see that the pancreas generating new beta cells that are very functional and they're permanently functional. So now mice that have either type 1 or type 2 diabetes are essentially disease-free. We've done it with multiple sclerosis, autoimmune models. We've done it with Crohn's and colitis models. In all cases, there is a dual effect. Three steps. One, you get rid of damaged components. And so let's say autoimmune cells. You start decreasing the autoimmune cells. You start decreasing the cancer cells. And then with that, you also decrease the inflammation. Then you turn on stem cells and other regenerative processes. I mean, stem cells are one of the major ones, but there's probably others. And three, and only when you go back to the refeeding, and that's a trick that calorie restriction did not have, meaning If you're calorie restricted all the time, you never have this, the more most important part, which is not the fasting, but it's the refeeding, right? The refeeding is when you, the fasting takes the building down. The refeeding builds a new one. And so that's that. That is the process I think that is so important. Now, you know, of course, I'm exaggerating. It's not a whole new building, but certainly it seems to be a part of the building is now being renovated. And that part seems to be brand new and functional. And possibly the reason for that is an evolution, something that is evolved and it's very sophisticated. So we think of this as, oh, this is things that, you know, my grandma used to do. But if done correctly, and only if done correctly, and you avoid all the side effects, now that can turn on an incredibly sophisticated, I call it 3 billion years of research and development, because this started really in the prokaryotes billions of years ago, this idea that, you know, if you don't have any food, most microorganisms are starving most of the times, and they eat once in a while, and then they go back to starving. And so when the moment of feeding comes, they need to really expand and be ready to go. And so that's why this refeeding moment seems to be the moment where things get rebuilt in a correct way, using very sophisticated embryonic development-like programs.
Right. So really the first 2 to 3 days is how long it takes the body on the fasting mimicking diet to transition from, you know, sugar burning to fat burning. And then the body out of in this kind of mimicked starve phase gets rid of the damaged cells and then triggers the stem cells that with refeeding kind of rejuvenate healthier cells. So in this way, for example, if a person's diabetic and the damaged cells were in the pancreas, which produces the insulin, or in the muscle cells, you're really getting healthier new pancreatic cells, et cetera. And the same is happening in different organs, which is why this diet helps a multitude of chronic conditions.
Well, yes. I mean, we know this for mice. And we know this for people that are relatively healthy, right? So we see insulin sensitization, or certainly evident insulin sensitization in people that might have prediabetes. And also we have initial studies on multiple sclerosis in humans. Now the demonstration that what we demonstrate in mice, the demonstration in humans is not there yet for type 1 diabetes and even for type 2 diabetes and et cetera, et cetera. So there's lots of trials, and so we have to wait and see. But certainly there is optimism that it will work in many of these indications, and we just have to wait and see. For example, we're about to publish on cancer, some exciting work. I cannot say what it is, but certainly it's using the fasting mimicking diet together with cancer treatment, and it's working very well. So there's going to be several publications on that in the next 6 months, and we're excited about continuing in this direction and seeing what how far we can take it. But you know, again, the ambition is to really have it in the doctor's office, whether it's an oncologist or. And I think in different, you know, we're going to have failures. Not everything is going to work. But I think the idea is let's say that we do something for a certain autoimmunity and it doesn't work, is to say, well, there's got to be a way to make it work. And so we just got to keep going until there is going to be something that, in fact, is able to take the autoimmunity to go after the autoimmune cells and replace those with functional ones. So. It's just, I think, a matter of time before either this dietary intervention or another one is going to be able to be effective.
Yeah, and you'd mentioned that the critical part is the specifics behind the fasting mimicking diet, the components, the calories, all the elements to it. The first day is 1,100 calories, then days 2 through 5 are 800, and the diet is primarily complex carbohydrates, as well as fats from healthy fats like nuts and olive oil. How did that diet come about in terms of the specifics of those recommendations?
Yeah, I talk now about a new field, you know, that we have from a pharmaceutical field, we have the biotechnology field. I really think now it's time for the nutri-technology field. And it's very different from functional food. Why? Because I think it's about understanding the complexity of food compositions and then say, how do I orchestrate genetic responses in cells and organs by modulating or changing the dietary composition? And that's where all this comes from. Yeah? So you know, the low protein, high fat, complex carbs, it's just trying to achieve many, many different things. So on one side, it's trying to achieve lowering of IGF-1, lowering of TOR, lowering of PKA, but it's also trying to achieve other things. For example, we don't want blood pressure to go too low. We don't want hypoglycemia. We don't want hypotension, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, and we also want people to feel relatively full. I mean, they're not going to be very full, but certainly we want them to be feeling, we want this to be acceptable to people. We also want intestine to be emptied as much as possible, but we don't want to leave the intestine empty because, you know, as we've shown recently, the water-only fasting increases the leakiness of the gut because normally when you do water-only fasting, there's no food in the gut. And as somebody now has some damage in the gut, this could make things worse. And in fact, in our mouse model for Crohn's and colitis, water-only fasting made it worse for the mice in combination with this DSS, intestinal toxin. I'm just listing a few, but in every disease we're thinking, in every condition, so Prolon is the 5 days fasting vegan diet that you just described. But then for cancer, there's a 4 day, much lower calorie. For autoimmunity, it's 7 days long, but the same calories. For Alzheimer's, it's 5 days long, but it's much higher calories. And there's a supplementation in between. So we really think about the patient, who we have in front of us, what the age is, et cetera, et cetera. And then we think about this nutri-technology and how do we change the things that we want to change without hurting the patient.
Yeah, which is a very unique approach, you know, looking at the genetic changes that are being triggered in terms of arriving at the various components. And, you know, you'd mentioned that you've been doing this, you know, following this dietary plan for years. What are ways that if you wanted to check, okay, how are you aging, if you will, at a level before we're going to catch it by typical testing? For example, you know, what I'm thinking is in a lot of our clinical trials, when we are looking at, you know, biologic age different from chronologic age, we are looking at epigenetic age acceleration. You know, for our audience who's not familiar with that, it's on how we are changing, how our genes are getting expressed through modifications on our genes. You know, we can certainly measure IGF-1 levels, we can measure insulin resistance, but getting at this question of how do we measure where we are on the spectrum of how healthy we're aging is really a tough one because a lot of the testing tends to be more focused on early diagnosis of disease as opposed to kind of these changes that are accelerating aging and leading to disease before they're ever manifest. Is there like maybe a profile of labs or recommended tests to do if we just want to do a snapshot of aging?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's certainly the epigenetic clock. But also we've been, and we're going to publish soon, and Morgan Levine at Yale has come up with a formula, basically a set of markers that are usually between 7 and 10, and they include some of these usual suspects, including, for example, C-reactive proteins, But some of them they're not necessarily risk factors for diseases, but she has shown that there is a high correlation between this marker, which can easily be measured in any clinic, and the chance of dying or dying of a particular disease from the enhanced database. So then she can predict that risk by the pattern or the levels of all these different markers. I think I really like that more than anything else, more than telomeres and more than other techniques, because I think it combines the risk factors. Let's say 2/3 of them are risk factors for diseases. So, and the risk factor for disease, for example, if you take C-reactive protein, obviously if somebody is high C-reactive protein, not only are they at high risk for cardiovascular disease, but something is wrong. Something is not functioning well. Why is the liver now making this pro-inflammatory molecule? And yeah, so that's why I really like that method of Morgan, because in the worst case scenario, it really picks up on lots of things that are going wrong with you. But also almost for sure, there's also a true aging component. So it's picking up on the biological age and not just on the disease risk factor.
Yeah, no, exactly. Kind of blending the genetics plus the clinical markers to get at the best approximation. And Dr. Longo, our time is short. I wanted to ask, is there any advice or anything that you want to share with our audience that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
Yeah, I think an extra one, which we talked a little bit about, but not very much, is the 12 hours. So keeping meals within 12 hours, don't go much longer. Too many people are now doing these 16, 18 hours of intermittent fasting. There's lots of negative data associated with breakfast skipping. There's also negative data with gallstone formation for people that go 16, 18 hours a day. 12 hours seems to be very good type of time restricted eating. So that's for sure a good one there. And I think, most of all the things we talked about, the fasting mimicking diet, I always say it's a need to do it basis, meaning most people need to do it probably 3 times a year. Some people, if somebody's obese and has high blood pressure, high cholesterol, maybe they need to do it once a month until they move to a better area. And if somebody is in perfect shape and, 28 years old, maybe just, a couple times a year is sufficient. So it's also important to keep in mind that we don't know everything about these things. And at the beginning, it's probably good to be cautious.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. So your research is just fascinating. And I appreciate all that you've shared with us and really appreciate the time you've taken today to talk and join me on the podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.